filthy lucre. And that has given rise to the popular misconception that the Bible is anti-money. Now, it is discussed in a great length. There's more in the New Testament about money than there is about prayer or about heaven. One of the commonest misquotations of the New Testament is that money is the root of all evil. What actually said in Timothy is that, 1 Timothy is that the love of money is the root of all evil. Money excites a love that is poisonous to human well-being, but that springs up new life when there's no stronger love present in a human heart. Remove the love of God, and many will love money instead. And that will give rise to much evil and to much unhappiness in human life. Now, when we get converted, the Spirit of God excites in our hearts a love for God, which makes us hunger and thirst after righteousness. And that is what drives out the love of money. A consuming lust for material prosperity cannot coexist with the longing to be good. Can't have both. And what the Bible tells us is not so much don't love money, but it tells us to love, to hunger and thirst righteousness. If we long for righteousness, then money finds its right place in our lives. It becomes a means of expressing our trust and our obedience to God, our gratitude for what he has done to us. His amazing grace. So the more we then have it, the better. Because then we can yield it powerfully in the cause of God's kingdom. And that's something the Bible is very keen on us doing. So what are we to do with money then? Well, it's obvious, we're to use it. We're to give it away. We're to spend it. That's what money is for. Use worldly wealth, says Jesus, to gain presents for yourselves, so that when it fails, you will be welcomed into eternal money. You see, money will fail. It is essentially temporary. Leave it all behind. The Arabs say, a shroud has no pocket. Pickford won't even quote them for a move from here on. Remember the story of the banker's funeral? And they were going to sing Guy Fieri about Great Jehovah with its ending death of death and hell's destruction. Land is safe on Canaan's side. But they misprinted it. It read, land, my safe. On Canaan's side. But money is essentially temporal. There will be no sin on Canaan's side. But our use of money can give it an eternal significance. We can't take it with us, but we can take its effects. There's a story of a wealthy Christian man who was cautiously prudent in his use of money. He provided very well indeed for his family. He took out an insurance policy and had ISAs and a well-managed portfolio of approved investments. And he died before the present procession. And he was led by his guardian angel to his dwelling place in heaven. They passed through a lovely dwelling. He came at last to a hall made out of corrugated iron and colorful boxes. And the man was aghast. I'm very sorry, said the angel. He did the very best with the material he sent to him. Now that story doesn't bear detailed theological analysis, but more than one heresy lurking implicit in it. But it is a very good test of our Christian faith and of our devotion to God, how we use our money. It says that the last part of the anatomy that the Christian faith touches is a person's pocket. It's also said that it is wonderful how a Christian begins to grow when he or she begins to give. And somehow it is harder for us, those of us who have much. Stephen Alford tells of a Christian businessman traveling in Korea. And one day he saw in the field by the side of the road a young man pulling a rude plow while an old man behind held the handles and pushed down into the soil. And the businessman was a little amused by the sight of these two men plowing into the bedrock. And he said to the missionary who was accompanying him, that's a curious picture. I suppose these people are very poor their church was being built. They were eager to give something to it. They hadn't got any money, so they decided to sell their one and only apartments and give the proceeds to the church. This spring, they are pulling the plug inside. And this time, someone then said, I must be in a real sacrifice. They didn't want that commission with them. They rather thought it was fortunate that they had a box to sell. But that businessman got back from the UK. He showed the photograph that he'd taken to his pastor. And he told them all about it. He said, I want to double my giving and do some plumbing. But the point of the story is not that. It's the remark that those two Koreans thought it was fortunate that they had a box to sell. Well, we're going to look at those verses in 1 Corinthians 16 now. They're verses which illustrate how to give. And let's notice, first of all, that giving is something on which there should be teaching. Paul says there in verse 1, now I'm like a collection to God's people. Do what I told the Galatian churches to do. He makes no apologies for giving specific instruction about giving. And my hunch is that certainly I have talked too little in this area. And I've been reluctant to be specific about giving. Paul wasn't. He was quite happy to instruct them clearly about it. And I hope we're going to find specific help in these verses now. We'll put them quite there's the first one. Our giving should be focused. Notice Paul talks about the collection for God's people at the beginning of verse 1. It's a concern of Paul's mentioned at several places in his letters. We know from what he says at the end of Romans that this was a collection for the poor among the Christians and saints, people in Jerusalem. Notice that here he doesn't feel the need to remind the Corinthians of the recipient's poverty, of their need. He doesn't mention that this is for the poor, but he does remind them it's for their fellow believers. There is something to teach us from it. The world gives at times quite generously in response to perceived need. Remember what the tsunami created in terms of generosity in the Western world? Hearts are moved. People respond generously. We hear of a famine, we see the pictures on the media, emotions are aroused, there's a huge response sometimes. But the Christian's motivation, as we go to this beginning, is quite different. Not that we're untouched by the needs of the world. Indeed, I suspect our hearts are often broken. It's a burden for us, isn't it? We worship the loving God, and yet this world is so full of those who suffer. But our giving is a matter between us and God. It's an act of trust. It's an act of obedience. It's an act of gratitude. It's an act of love to God. It isn't done out of pity for mankind, not by man. You see, my attitude should not be, what cause can I give to and how much does it deserve? Our attitude should be, what is God's will in terms of how he is possible? And I have to say, I think that is quite different. Verse 1 would also seem to suggest that it's the needs of the believers to which we should give our first attention. And that may seem very odd, but actually it's consistent with the rest of Scripture. Jesus says in John 13, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. God knows how hard it is to be one another. And what we do, we don't think it's hard, we haven't done it. He means to do. He knows how hard it is, and so he's given us a purpose. We must learn first to express this love within the brothers, within the family, within the household of God. Because if we can't do it there, all your and my protestations that our hearts reach out in love to the rest of the world will go empty. And so we are to give first to Christian concerns and to Christian needs. We give to conform ourselves to God's revealed will, not merely to express humanitarian concern. If we get that wrong, there are two traps we'll fall into wrong motives. One is going to be guilt. We'll feel guilty that we're not giving enough. And into a congratulatory. Well, let's move on. Secondly, our giving needs to be ordered and regular, according to Paul, in these verses. He says, verse 2, on the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money and keep it with his income, saving it up, so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Our giving is to be ordered and regular. Money is to be regularly set aside. First day was the day when they met for what we call worship. Misuse of work, worship is hardly on the whole of our lives. And money is an important part of that. But it's an important part of our lives, basically. So Paul says to the Philippians with regard to the gifts they have sent him, he calls them a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. So it's quite in order to have a collection in a certain way. But it's quite important to have what you want. That's why. Putting our hands in our pockets to respond to a collection is every bit as much as spiritual as raising our hands in praise and prayer. And it's an enjoyable thing. We enjoy it. We love to give our money to it as Christians. We don't yet enjoy it. It's been a sacrifice. To the light. And it's an important thing that is one of the main ways to worship. Now listen, this is pretty significant. More significant than something we worship. Our giving should be systematic. And I wonder if we are as systematic in giving as we are in other financial matters. You may want to think about that. Some of us will be very careful attention. Thirdly, from these verses, our giving should be individual and proportional. Notice that our giving is individual and proportional from verse 2. Each one of you should set aside a sum of money, not just for welfare. Now, professional fundraisers know that one person who can give £100,000 is worth more of their attention than 100 people who can only give £100. Paul could have gone for the wealth. He could have gone for the wealthy between you, but he didn't, because it's not God's will. All are to share in the blessing, rich and poor. Remember that story that Jesus told to the poor widow and the two others. Each is to decide for himself or herself how much, and the guy who sits there will keep you with his income. Is that God's will? Our giving should be proportional. Some of us can give more. Some of us can give less, and we should adjust it as we prosper. There will be times when circumstances in life change, and we find we can give less than we should have given before. More frequently, perhaps, in most of the circumstances, why we go the other direction, we're able to give more than we did. Now we go to the time of recession. It would be a pity when we agree as Christians to give and adjust our giving time. Before we make any other change. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if the recession did not affect the giving of this? That's the treasure of the greatest of the little mighty things. I fear that often we get so entangled in financial commitments that they have a way of working in advance in our market that you can be allowed a certain mortgage because of the future expectation of your earning. And it's very hard somehow to get our giving sorted out first before these other financial entanglements have already got us by the plan. So we end up giving God what is left instead of starting with it and doing our calculations for Him first and foremost. I guess many of us worry about money. I might worry about money. I want to add on one personal tip here. I do not intend this in any way to be a burden because I'm not through with money. I don't have a great deal of money in the church of England clergymen, but I certainly worry about it. And I find when I'm worrying about it, when I have only this kind of one source of money, every time I put more money away, when I do more money, I'm worried about it. And I have to say, after 40 years, I've been hands, so that when I come, no collection will have to be made. No ripping up of an offering under pressure. No spur of the moment, no emotionalism. It's the rational, thoughtful, prayerful, and grateful. It's a matter of giving and standing in order. And I can't tell you how much treasure is like standing in order. It's absolutely right. We're settling the matter quietly with God first. It's a matter of spiritual obedience. We'll be here than flow of our lives. That's the goal of this. It is the order, regular, systematic, individual, personal, proportionate, and now fourthly, collective and corporate. Look at verses 2 and 3. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with his income, saving it up, so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. Then, when I arrive, I will give letters of introduction to the men you approve and send them with your gift to Jerusalem. Paul arranges for the giving to be by a representative, a collective effort to make a corporate gesture of unity with the Jewish Christians. Now, no doubt he could have sent a long string of individual gifts in the direction of Jerusalem. But that's not what Paul wanted to do. He wanted the church to unite, to give together. And I think, generally speaking, Christian giving should be church-centered. Now again, I think this flies in the face of current attitude. We are much conditioned in the Western world by Western individualism. We'll do our own little bit, anonymously, yes, by all means, but by sending off our own checks in different directions from different charities that we personally have selected to give to. The ones we think particularly merit our attention. Now, I don't want to exclude that. Of course there's a place for individual donations to church. But it's not the pattern the New Testament seems to present. I want to suggest that we are meant to give together. My little gift is made much greater by all of your gifts. And so together we're able to do something quite substantial. And I would encourage you to give via the church, give via the body of Christ. Because we double the benefit of our gifts in that way. We build up the charity or the missionary to whom the money is going, but we also encourage the fellowship. And sometimes we have a special gift to give. Somebody who's going to have left some money or something, you can give a quite substantial sum. Now, if we channel that gift through the fellowship to which we belong, the whole of the fellowship is blessed by the knowledge of the amount of money that's being given. Last January, after Chris Hayward's death, some Peter signed in the fellowship to hand bread that we really ought to have all the time. I hate an elephant after we work in the world of bread, and there's a lot of orders of the financing standards that in court we should give at least a certain sum. There's a notion fixed for me, but some of the inside, but if we're retiring or did not come to that one, then we would make it up. From Central Church. But what they gave at that time? They gave 10 times. More than 10 times. The faith of the vicar's new expected. It was a shame. It was a kind of not an ink, but a shame for the vicar's new. But what a wonderful encouragement for everybody there. You see, our giving can bring a double benefit, no extra cost to ourselves. Now, I've no doubt these Corinthians were greatly encouraged by this endeavor, which Paul had launched among them, to make this gesture to the Corinthians in Jerusalem. Well, we're near there. You can go and face it. And again, time's only got 25 minutes, and I'm well inside. So finally, we are to give carefully. He's going to send it by people they have accredited. You notice that? Verses 3 and 4, then when I arrive, I'll give letters of instruction to the men you approve and send them with your gift to Jerusalem. If it seems advisable for me to go also, they will accompany me. Then we go carefully, scrupulously. make sure there could be no, nothing could be go wrong in any way. Although it was all of own initiative, he arranged this collection, he would not himself have all the money. Actually, that's not the strength of the Anglican system. That is one of them. For we clergy, our salaries have no connection at all with the strength of our own particular church. It doesn't matter how generous the material estates or how weak, Simon and Tony will go in exactly the same way. And that's very good thing. It's just not. Let me stop there. I hope these four verses help you and me to think through our giving. And I hope you will settle the matter with God and then act with his people. There's two dimensions to it. You settle it with God, then we act with other Christians. Let me end with one story from Alan Redman. He tells the story. A certain Christian once said to a friend, "Our church costs too much money. They're always asking for money." "Some time ago, a little boy was doing that," replied the friend. "He cost me a lot of money from the very beginning. He had a big appetite. He needed clothes, medicine, toys, even a puppy. Then he went to school, and that cost a lot more. Later, he went to college, and then he began dating, and that cost a small fortune. But in his final year at college, he died. And since the funeral, he hasn't been to the end of it." The living church has the most vital message in all the world. Therefore, I'm going to hear and pray. Father God, we want to thank you that you have been very good in blessing us with great riches, which is far beyond what we deserve. And above everything else, you've blessed us with Jesus, and the salvation, the knowledge of you, the relationship with our Father that he can bring to us, that he can share with us. And we want to pray that you would so convince us of your grace, your goodness, your love towards us, that our hearts might overflow with gratitude. Everything we have in our lives can be a blessing. Lord, teach us to live for you, and teach us to use you.